This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And now for the moment all you readers have been waiting for, the Sci-Fi Book Club, if I had a gavel, is coming to order. It's back after a hot, dry month on the planet Arrakis. We've reconvened to talk about this summer's book pick, Frank Herbert's sci-fi classic Dune. If you've been sampling the spice, you already know it's going to be a great discussion. We want you to join us. We want you to talk about what you thought, Dune. I'm sure you've read it. Maybe you read it the first time 30 or so years ago, and you've read it now. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. Let me introduce our book club members. Kim Stanley Robinson is a Hugo and Nebula Award-winning sci-fi author. His latest novel is Shaman. Welcome back, Stan.
Thanks, Ira. Good to be here.
You're welcome. Sarah Omari Walker is an astrobiologist and theoretical physicist. She's an assistant professor at the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science. That's at Arizona State University. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thanks. Very excited to be here.
Me too. Annie Minhoff is Science Friday Sci Arts producer, and this is like her book club. So I'm going to turn it over to...
It's everyone's book club.
Give us a 30-second recap, Annie, of what Dune is all about.
Okay. This is an almost 900-page book, so I'll do my best. So Paul Atreides is the son of Duke Leto Atreides, and when we first meet him, they are getting ready to assume control of the planet Dune, Arrakis, a place where we're told there is never a drop of rain. And they are very quickly overthrown by their enemies, the almost comically evil Harkonnens. And Paul has to kind of make his way on this new planet, and we kind of get to discover Arrakis along with him. Mm-hmm. So,
Stan and Sarah, you've read Dune a long time ago, or did you reread it? What do you think? Did it hold up? Over the years? I'll get Sarah go first.
I know. We keep doing this. It's too exciting not to jump in. I was going to say, for me, it's been a really interesting experience rereading this book, living in the desert while I'm reading it. It's kind of, I live in Phoenix, and you know, the summers in Phoenix are very Iraqian, let's put it that way. And also thinking about the science has been really exciting after all those years. So it's been really fun.
So you think it held up over the years?
I do. Actually, that's one of the fantastic things about Dune. It has enough detail to get you excited and thinking about the science, but it's not too much detail that it's not still relevant. So mm-hmm. I think that's really kind of cool. So for me, it's been interesting as a puzzle to try to figure out, you know, could these things work or not, and how would they work based on modern science.
That's so true. He just gives you enough of the science to kind of give you the sense that this could work.
It's like a teaser.
Right, yeah. But not enough to get him in trouble.
Right.
But what about you, Stan, revisiting it after all these years?
Well, the interesting thing for me was that when I first read it, I was a student, and now when I'm reading it as another science fiction writer, and I was trying to think about Herbert as a writer, and he himself, this was his second novel, and I see signs of him learning to write novels in the course of writing Dune, and because the book seems to me to get better and better, it goes along and has a kind of a bang-up finish where you're really turning the pages, and it's quite exciting. So that was interesting. And then also this omniscient point of view that Herbert uses, where you can go into the mind of all characters, and even in one scene, three villains, you can see they're thinking in italics, and they're all thinking bad thoughts. Well, it looks a little bit crude and like pulpy, but I'm also thinking that no one ever did this very much in the whole history of the novel, and it's kind of interesting because it fits with Paul's own problems with precognition, and the narrator's playing the same games with the reader that Paul is experiencing as these flashes of the future, these kind of false flashes of the future. So that and the very formal kind of heavy style matches the content. And in the end, I was convinced and impressed by Herbert as a novelist.
Let's see. A lot of people want to talk about our number, 844-724-8255 is our number. First, let's go to Bend, Oregon. Jocelyn, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there.
Hey.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Thank you. I read Dune a long time ago, and one of the things that impressed me is Frank Herbert draws from a lot of culture, ancient cultures on Earth, and incorporates that into his books. But amongst the other things that the spice people find so attractive about the spices, it's called the geriatric drug. It prolongs the life of the people who take it, as well as gives them glimpses into the future, and the guild masters need it because they fold time and space, and that's how they get from point A to B. And that's what makes it so incredibly desirable and why it's so important for someone to control the planet Arrakis, as well as the tremendous ecological change that the Fremen are trying to affect on Arrakis, turning it from dry to wet.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the most powerful things about the spice is it's addictive. There's a scene where Paul realizes he'll never be able to leave this planet. He'll never be able to cut himself off from the spice because you're captive.
Yeah, that's a good analysis, Jocelyn. Thanks for calling. And you know, it's she. And the author, Frank Herbert, he sort of skirts around with the language a lot. Fremen instead of freemen. You know, freemen live with people who are free.
Just
living.
Enough so you just really don't know how to pronounce it. Thanks a lot, Frank.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
One thing I want to ask you about, Sarah, that has kind of a science bent in this book is that this is a universe where they've actually gotten rid of computers. It's an odd choice, and I wonder what you made of that.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite science themes of this novel. So a lot of people are really focused on the planet of Arrakis, and it's fascinating, the ecology and everything. But the whole notion of having this really advanced civilization that's gotten rid of anything that we really might recognize as technology, or just pretty much everything. I mean, they still have starships and things like that. But there's no real signs of technology on the planet. And everything that they do, all their computation is using human systems. And I think that's really fascinating, you know, because people even, you know, back in the days when this novel was written, people were really interested in artificial intelligence, and we're still trying to reach that target of artificial intelligence and haven't gotten there yet. And so it's kind of interesting to play with the idea that, you know, maybe the human brain and the way it's structured mm-hmm. is actually one of the most sophisticated computational systems in the universe, and it might just always be, you know, it is as far as we know now. And that maybe the better way to get these sort of advanced technologies is to enhance humans rather than try to build something from scratch. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really interesting idea, and it's very empowering for us as humans to think that we might actually, you know, be the technology of the future.
You know, Herbert writes about computers as a crutch. So when we took away computers, we took away a crutch. And he writes, it forced human minds to develop, which is kind of how I feel about my cell phone. You know, I don't need to remember directions anymore.
So this is sort of the anti-Ray Kurzweil idea.
Yes.
Well, there's a sort of a suggestion there that in some point in the human past, they had to fight off a takeover by machines.
Yes.
And that
right.
So that it was an interesting anti-Kurzweil, you know, that if you get to the moment of the so-called singularity, that human beings might fight back and exile machine intelligence in order to keep control of history.
Mm-hmm. Stan, you asked us to think about what Dune says about this year, 2014. What does it show us about our own times? What's your answer to that?
Well, we still are in a culture that looks a little bit too feudal for my tastes. Oligarchy, power from above, fighting of forces for in control of the natural resources that the whole civilization is hooked on like a drug. And you know, the comparisons to the Middle East and oil and mm-hmm. to the big powers of our time, it's a pretty easy translation to make. And it's interesting that Herbert was writing this in the 60s, and yet 50 years later, it's not a bad funhouse mirror reflection of our own society. It's depressing, but it also, there's the fight going on for liberation. So Paul's forces and the Fremen, they begin to look like political actors that can, you know, give us some inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones to Raz in Chicago. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I've read Dune several times over the years, and bluntly, I don't think it stood the test of time. It just doesn't quite, after all these years for me, resonate as it did the first time. And in reading Herbert's other works, it seems like a one-off, like he really hit a stride here, but it hasn't held up. However, the one thing I do love about it is, when I'm in a meeting or something or taking in a lot of information, I always go into Mentat mode and I just start taking in data. So that always helps me to understand and just take it in the information. So when you hear me say I'm in Mentat mode, giving some props to Mr. Herbert. I'm going to hang up. Thanks, bye.
I was going to ask him if he uses that in the office a lot. You know?
It sounds like, yeah. I want to throw out a question. We actually got this question submitted to us on the subreddit PrintSF from a user of that subreddit named Susan. And Stan, she actually noticed some parallels between Dune and your Mars trilogy books. In that, in both of those works, you have humans who are transforming the face of a planet to make it more comfy for humans, to make it habitable. And what are the ethics of that? So she asked this question. Can we ethically colonize another planet given the narrow band of conditions where human life can survive? What do you think about
well,
that?
It's a great question, and I would say that in my Mars books, I flip back and forth so many times on it that that's one of the reasons that book is so long and has its own energy, with different characters expressing the different points of view. But what I came to feel was that when we talk about another planet, it makes a huge difference whether there's already life there or not. So say Mars is dead, which is an open question right now, but it very well could be a dead planet. It's just rock. There's nothing living there. I don't see any problem with going there and terraforming it and turning it into a kind of an Arctic Earth or what have you, a Martian space that humans have terraformed and turned into a human space. I like that plan, and I having quickly to admit that it might be a 10,000 or 50,000 year plan and implies a very healthy Earth culture before it could ever happen. On the other hand, if say there's bacteria there, the whole thing goes into a completely different ethical register where you have to talk about invasive biology and disturbing already existing life forms that have their own intrinsic value, as they say in environmental ethics. So the question becomes, can you find out whether Mars is alive or dead, whether bacteria are there or not, before you've already contaminated it? So we're in a very awkward spot in the most terraformable planet that we know of.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with our book club members about this month's book, which is Dune, Frank Herbert's Dune. Sarah Imari Walker and Annie Minoff is here, and Kim Stanley Robinson. Our number 844-724-8255. Let me see if I can go to a tweet that came in. This is from Stephen Yenzer, who said, "What made Dune so great for me was Herbert's take how ecology influences culture. Lots of similarities with the Ligai-Hanish cycle." Anybody know what that's about?
Yes. Well, yes, he means Ursula K. Le Guin, one of our greatest science fiction writers, and someone who's taught me so much about writing science fiction. And her Hanish cycle means really the Left Hand of Darkness, The Dispossessed, and five or six other novels in which a previous race of humans have basically gone through the galaxy trying out experiments in humans in different contexts, and we would be one of those experiments.
Oh,
and
man.
In the Left Hand of Darkness, the people are have only one sex, and then they reproduce by becoming sexual only on occasion and can become male or female. Quite a mind-boggling and great novel. So I think that's what he's referring to there. And you know, Herbert and Le Guin began at the same time, and it really was a moment when science fiction stepped up to a larger stage and became better than it ever had been before.
Mm-hmm. What was overwhelming to me in the book, besides the interesting idea that they could terraform the planet in 350 years,
yes,
was the treachery. The incredible treachery that was going on all the time between the characters.
Well, and there's even the suggestion that that has to do with the ecology, too. At one point, the planetary ecologist Pardo Kynes, I believe, says, you know, this is all an outgrowth of the fact that Dune is a one-crop planet. You have the spice, and whoever controls the spice is the boss, and everyone else doesn't have any power. So it kind of builds in this power dynamic where, of course, people are always striving to get what they can, and it's not very equitable.
It's a tough neighborhood, as they say.
Yeah.
Also, it's a medieval Europe neighborhood where family matters. It's inherited power, so there's nepotism, there's double dealing. If you happen to be the first son rather than the second son, or if you're the only surviving son, etc. So there's a lot of backstabbing and double dealing. And that struck me too, Iris. I'm glad you said that. It's a very mean neighborhood and a mean crowd for the most part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting how the addiction plays into that, because a lot of the treachery is, you know, everybody's also addicted to the spice, and so it's... it's like everybody's lifeblood at the same point.
Mm-hmm. Kim, is there any science that just is so bad in it that you say, oh, it hurts you to read about it?
Well, you know, from our discussion last month, I'm still reeling from an idea that had never occurred to me, which is that the stillsuits don't work. And I'm an English major, and I took them for granted and thought, oh, what a cool idea. But I've also been in wetsuits in the ocean. I know how much you heat up when you're in a bodysuit. So the whole month I've been wandering around thinking, well, if I was writing Dune and I wanted those stillsuits, how could I make them work? And yet I don't think it's a good idea. So I have to confess that it's Sarah and Annie that have brought that to my attention, but I don't see a great solution for that one. Ecologically, I think, you know, they're terraforming. They're trying to spread grasses. They've got a certain amount of ice up in the polar caps. All that, as was just said earlier, there's just enough to make it kind of work.
Sarah, do you agree? Is there anything that stands out that's, scientifically?
Yeah, so that's a big one. But the other one for me is sort of one of the powers of the Bene Gesserit is that they can control every molecule in their body, you know, and like get down to like atomic resolution. And you know, that's one of the reasons that they can become Bene Gesserit is they convert the poison of the spice into something, you know, that's not going to affect them. And for me, I'm trying to think of like the computational power that would be necessary to calculate where every atom in your body is. And could your brain actually do that? And so to me, that doesn't really, you know, it doesn't bode well that that's actually physically possible.
Well, thank you.
It's fun to think about.
Yeah.
But.
And we got through the whole segment without giving away a spoiler. So that's good for anybody who hasn't read Dune yet and wants to read it. It's a
you
great book.
It, yeah.
Let me thank my guest, Sarah Imari Walker, who is an astrobiologist, theoretical physicist at Arizona State University, Kim Stanley Robinson Hugo, a Nebula Award-winning sci-fi author. His latest novel is Shaman. And Annie Minoff, our Science Friday SciArts producer. Thank you all.
Thank you.
We'll be back with the next month's book when we figure out what that is. Before we go, on a reminder, you won't want to miss, if you're in Southern California, come see Science Friday live in Pasadena on August 27th. We're going to be doing the show from there. We're talking about science and storytelling with actors and screenwriters from Avatar, folks from The Big Bang Theory, and more. And we're going to play a game of movie science, fact versus fiction. So come on out. Sit in the audience and meet the gang. Here's how to get tickets. You go to sciencefriday.com/LA and get the tickets because there are not many left before they sell out. That's at sciencefriday.com/LA. We're going to have to say goodbye, but we'll be back next week from Pasadena. So stay good to see you next week. I hope to see you come out and see the show. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.